Stoveleg Media, igniting conversation.
We are joined again today by Jarrett Ferrantino, federal and state trial lawyer, 2 decades of experience, and now a true crime personality with an awesome show with Lauren Conlon, Primetime Crime. Jarrett, thanks for joining us.
Thank you, guys. Great to see you again, John and Jamie.
You as well. The last time we had you on, we talked about Hugo Selinsky and your role as the prosecutor there, but you've had some other high profile cases, and that's kind of, we want to talk to you about one of those today. Are there any cases that you feel like you've been a part of before we get into this? We're going to talk about the murder and investigation of Brittany Drexel. Are there any that you felt like should have been higher profile? And by high profile, I just mean known publicly.
Yeah, I certainly know exactly what you mean. You know, there, in northeastern Pennsylvania, I've certainly had cases that were pretty big deals here. I've had every kind of case. So I've had gangbangers, I've had child murderers, wife killers. But when you look back, there are some that really stand out. I mean, the baby cases certainly stand out, but they tend not to get the kind of national attention because they're so, people don't like to dwell on those things. I mean, they're just tragic. But I have to say, I had a case a couple of years ago where 4 juveniles killed one of the juvenile's grandfathers very violently, beat him to death with a golf club. While it was two guys and 2 girls, and they robbed his safe of about $30,000. That one, I was surprised didn't catch more fire. It was so outrageous and so violent and so sad for a grandfather who really looked out for his granddaughter. His name was Joseph Monka, M-O-N-K-A, if anybody wants to look it up. But very sad case, and the case ultimately resolved, but it was during COVID, and we were set to try the case in the Wilkes-Barre Arena, believe it or not, because we needed to social distance people. Sure. And right at the end, right on the eve of trial, everyone pled. So there were 4 co-defendants. They ultimately pled out. That was one I was surprised did not get more attention just based on the circumstances. The other one I had, which did get some national attention, was the drive-by shooting of Michael Only, DJ Mo, who, it was a cold case for a while in northeastern Pennsylvania, and it has certainly gotten some attention. There was a documentary done last year, and that case went cold. I prosecuted it in 2016, I believe, 2019. And we have DJ Mo Day coming up in October here in Wilkes-Barre, Pennsylvania, where they celebrate Michael's life. Yeah. He was a local DJ, local college radio. Michael was civically active, used to have community nonviolent rallies because his brother was killed. And tragically, he was killed in a drive-by killing by 2 guys who were thrown out of a club where he was at that night. It had nothing to do with the guys or what happened to them. So that those are the ones that kind of, when anyone asks me about the cases I've had, in addition to Hugo and the Brittany Drexel case, kind of jump out at me.
So do you care to tell us a little bit more about Brittany Drexel? I know she was she disappeared, but why don't you just talk to us as if we don't know anything about the case, and then we'll go from there.
Well, so Brittany Drexel was a 17-year-old, high school student who wanted to go from Rochester, New York to spring break in Myrtle Beach. She asked her mom, Dawn Drexel, at the time if she can go, and her mom said no. Sometime later, she told her mother that, fine, if she couldn't go to a spring break, she was going to go to a friend's and stay there for the weekend out at a lake. She snuck down to Myrtle Beach, unbeknownst to her mom, stayed down there with friends. She was staying at the Bar Harbor Hotel down there, and there were a group of kids down there from Rochester, and the other group was staying at the Blue Water Hotel. So Brittany went down to visit her other friends, stayed there for a short time, in and around 8:30 p.m. on April 25th, 2009, Brittany left the Blue Water Hotel, headed back to the Bar Harbor Hotel on the main strip in Myrtle Beach. She was texting her boyfriend, John, at the time, and vanished off the face of the earth. She is pictured. There's a famous picture of Brittany Drexel leaving the Blue Water Hotel. That is really the last image of Brittany alive and well. There was some surveillance footage that picked her up later, thanks to just dogged FBI agents that reviewed all this stuff. But really, you had a point A where Brittany left and a point B where she never arrived. And then you had her cell phone pinging and texting in and out from 8:45-ish till 9:06 p.m. And Brittany vanished. Her boyfriend was repeatedly texting her. She was not responding. The texts actually say, Brittany, if you don't answer, I'm going to call your mom. I'm worried that something's wrong. And inevitably, John called her mom, and her mom then learned to her shock that Brittany was not at a friend's nearby. She was in South Carolina, 600 plus miles away, and was lost. So Dawn, at that point, had a friend nearby go out and start looking for Brittany. And then she began to make arrangements to get down there to find her. And that kicked off a 13-year search for Brittany Drexel. That's basically, you know, Brittany's story is that story you tell your kids at night. Like, don't lie to us about where you're going to be. Be careful. I mean, this was a busy street. You know, it was Ocean Boulevard in Myrtle Beach. Just a tragic, tragic case. And it just kicked off a 13-year odyssey searching for her with a lot of twists and turns in the case. And ultimately, in May of 2022, May 11th, 2022, Brittany's body was found in a shallow grave in Georgetown, South Carolina, some 30-plus miles away from where she was last seen. And that's where the second part of the story begins.
Sure. We live in Kentucky, and Myrtle Beach is a very common vacation destination for people here. A lot of folks from New York going down to Myrtle Beach. Is that
for whatever reason, the kids from Rochester at that time in 2009, prior to and for some time after, would go to Myrtle Beach. Now, I'm from northeastern Pennsylvania. We would go to Maryland.
Sure.
You know, our guys, 5 hours was a lot for us to drive out to the shore. So these guys were really taking a road trip. I mean, that was a long trip. What did I say? It was
600 miles. Yeah.
I think it's even more than that.
It's a lot. And I bring that up to say I'm very familiar with that area, knowing how busy it is, knowing that it's very few people from Myrtle Beach are actually in Myrtle Beach. I imagine that had an impact, just being in a big tourist location, on the investigation, because the easy solution is she just went off on her own and wanted to disappear. But what was the early investigation like? It was, I know they were tracking the pings, but they pretty quickly just kind of ran out of leads.
Well, the investigation, so you raise a good point. Most of the community are tourists. And so they had to kind of reverse engineer Brittany's time there. Who was she with? Where was she going? Is she being trafficked? Was she targeted? Was it somebody she knew? And initially, suspicion fell upon some of the folks that she knew down there, that were living down there. There was a young man named Peter who, and if you look up this case, inevitably the Dr. Phil episode comes up where Peter was confronted. Mm-hmm. Suspicion fell on him. A lot of suspicion fell upon them because they were acting inconsistent with people that were concerned. And, you know, the suspicion was maybe Brittany was trafficked and targeted by these kids. And that's not what happened at all. But that was initially what was thought to have transpired here. But what really, so that was the initial, I would say, working theory. Mm-hmm. That theory didn't bear any fruit. Okay. So at some point they hit a brick wall. From 2009, Don ran a group of volunteers and investigators and just passionate locals that worked with her searching for Brittany everywhere. And the searches were brutal. They were in the swamps. They were in mosquito infested waters. I mean, they were looking high and low for Brittany. Eventually, the trail ran cold. In 2015, so now we're 6 years out, the FBI had developed certain leads and they had gotten information from a jailhouse informant that these young African men, the Taylors, were involved. Timothy and Deshaun Taylor, father and son, were involved in Brittany's disappearance. And there were jailhouse informants providing information basically in support of that theory. So the FBI at some point has a press conference and they say that there's been significant developments in the case and they're moving closer toward an arrest. And they were seeking certain information related to, now, without naming the Taylors, they were seeking information related to the area of McClellanville and the areas outside of Myrtle Beach. Shortly after that press conference, there was a hearing for Timothy Taylor. And in that hearing, law enforcement argues in support of his bail being revoked or something related to an unrelated charge that a jailhouse informant has said Brittany Drexel was gang raped, shot, wrapped in a carpet, and fed to alligators.
Jeez.
So that became, first of all, talk about your worst nightmare. That became Don Drexel's reality. You know, that was what she learned was Brittany's fate. She had no reason to not believe that was her fate. It was an answer. She had gotten no answers at that point. So that was the working theory. The suspicion or expectation, I would say, was ultimately the Taylors will eventually be charged in this case. And these young men, Timothy Taylor and his father, were living in that community uncharged, but really implicated in this case and endured a nightmare, as you could imagine, because all the while they claimed we had nothing to do with this. Okay. And as months became years, that was not the theory that was being pursued, and they were not charged. Later on, so Don Drexel, Brittany's mother, becomes, as you could imagine, frustrated isn't even the word I would use. I would say more heartbroken, completely distrusting of law enforcement at that point. But she never gave up. She constantly would go down to Myrtle Beach, hand out flyers, looking for answers, would stay on law enforcement. And remind me, I want to say something about the power of her persistency. But eventually, a new team of FBI investigators formed to investigate this case. And their names were Mike, Caleb, and James. And these three guys were unbelievably committed to finding Brittany Drexel. And they began to re-examine old leads, old video footage. And when I say re-examine, I mean going through hundreds of hours. And eventually they're led back to a suspect, a sexual offender named Raymond Moody, who was in the area around the time of Brittany's disappearance. Eventually, they tighten the noose around Moody through the analysis of their video footage. His girlfriend, Angel, during the course of the investigation, meets with investigators, dances around what she knows, tells some fantastical stories, but then kind of relents on those stories. But confirming suspicions, Angel was circling the drain of suspicion here. Eventually, the investigators gather enough evidence and move on Raymond Moody. They go to him. They tell him the gig is up. They confront him with the evidence they have. He eventually comes, for the most part, clean on what happened. He says, basically, he claims Brittany approached he and Angel on Ocean Boulevard when they were driving by or parked along the road. They took her. They were driving with her to party. And eventually, Angel had left Raymond and Brittany alone. And he began to rape her, strangled her, killed her. Angel was said to have returned, and he told her that Brittany had gone off with her friends. And that was their story. They stuck to it. Raymond Moody led investigators to Brittany's body in Georgetown, and they unearthed her body on May 11th in 2022. That's the story pretty much from soup to nuts. Sure.
So at what point in that did you get involved? Was it after the arrest of Raymond, or were you involved
before? No. I became involved when law enforcement had... So a lot of people don't know that victims have a right to get attorneys too, okay? And I spent my years as a prosecutor fighting on behalf of victims in that role. But I have also been involved in cases on behalf of victims that, for whatever reason, have issues with law enforcement or having difficulty. Look at the Gonsalves family in Coburger, for example. They have their own counsel. So my role was a friend of mine had known Dawn. We've been doing true crime TV and had known her, and she was in need of a lawyer, recommended me in 2020, 2 years before Brittany was found. It was right after COVID started. Dawn had reached out to me and asked me to kind of translate what she was being told. She was disheartened. She was frustrated. She did not trust law enforcement. And this new team and FBI investigators was put together, and there was going to be a meeting in South Carolina. She had asked me to be a part of that. So that's where my role began. And over the course of the next 2 years, I would regularly participate in meetings with the investigators, with Dawn, take Dawn through the process. And as this was moving along, it became clear to me these guys were working really, really hard. And there was a good chance they were going to find Brittany and the people responsible. And sure enough, they did. And I was there when Moody was charged. I was there when Brittany's, let me say this, I went down when Moody was charged, and then I went back down to South Carolina when Moody pled guilty. So I was there with Dawn and her family and the media onslaught that ensued. And it was a tremendous experience. You know, after 20 years of doing this stuff, there are certain momentous occasions in your career and special moments, and all the time spent with Brittany's extended family and friends and the team that Dawn had with her. My buddy, Steph Watts, who's the true crime guy that brought me in. Those trips to South Carolina were very special. You know, they were bittersweet. They were sad, but they were also a celebration because finally, you know, there was closure. There were answers. And Dawn was under no delusion about Brittany's fate. She just wanted to properly bury her daughter and hold the people responsible. And she was getting all of that. So those trips were really, really special and a great thing to be a part of.
Did she eventually move down to South Carolina?
She moved to Florida.
Oh, okay.
So she did move from New York down to Florida. She still lives down in Florida.
Yeah. I knew she moved in part to help with the investigation, that kind of thing.
It's wild, man. Growing up, that was my family vacation, was going to Myrtle Beach. And so I've walked those streets as a young man myself. So my heart just breaks for Dawn. As far as Raymond is concerned, did his case go to trial or did he plead?
Raymond pled guilty. So I was in the courtroom with Dawn when the first time she saw Raymond. That was a surreal experience. He came in, he pled guilty and was immediately sentenced to life. So Moody came up with a version of events that, in my opinion, and in the opinion of many, insulated any culpability for Angel Voss, his girlfriend. She has since been charged and arrested by federal authorities for lying in this case. So her case is moving through the system now. She was set to plead guilty allegedly last week. She has not pled. It looks like she may be going to trial. I don't want to say too much about her case because I don't want to jeopardize that prosecution, other than to say she is facing charges related to Brittany Drexel's case right now, and the disposition of them remains uncertain at this point.
I grew up working on a farm in the summertime, and I mean, just hearing you tell me what you know about what Raymond had to say, it smells like bullshit.
Well, you know, I've found that killers and thieves lie about odd things. You know, they tell you half truths and they lie about curious things. And Moody is a self-proclaimed monster. I mean, he said, "I'm a monster." And Moody was in jail in California. He kidnapped, I think, six girls, kids.
Jeez.
And gets out of jail, goes back to Myrtle Beach. And Raymond became involved with a man named Ernie Merchant when he was in jail in California. They were together. That was, they were in a romantic relationship together. And Ernie moved to Myrtle Beach with Raymond when he first got out of prison in California. Ernie did not necessarily know what Ernie was incarcerated for, or what Raymond was incarcerated for originally. He learned later what Raymond was incarcerated for. And I came, ironically, Ernie and Dawn and I and our group of people came to know each other quite well, spent a lot of time together in South Carolina, maintain a friendship today. And Ernie wrote a book about his time in prison, about a fictional character based on Raymond Moody, if you read the book, but really has valuable insights into Moody himself, what he was like. And Ernie's been interviewed on television and things associated with the case. But, you know, wonderful guy and somebody who's been a great comfort to Don, believe it or not. You know, when you get into a world like this, not everyone, you know, you talk about Hugo Selinsky and these people, like there are a few people on the planet that can talk to you about what's going on and that understands it. And sometimes you'll find solace in defendants' family members or victims. So it was great for Don and Ernie to develop that friendship. And just a lot of people. I met so many people through this case that I've come to really build friendships with, and people that just supported Don. And they didn't, there was no money. There was just really people wanting to get a mother answers, you know, which was great. You know, it was very special to see that.
Yeah. The Good Morning America interview that you did with Don was very powerful, and her sharing some of that. And you mentioned her persistence earlier and kind of that power. Talk more about Don. Like, all families don't get to that point, so it's got to be you mentioned it was a celebration of finding the guy, putting the bad guy behind bars, but also you're confirming the worst case scenario. So what's that like with Don?
Well, there were certainly times of great emotion. But there were times, I mean, Don and her family liked to have a good time too. Yeah. So they did, you know, they were just, she was searching so long for those answers. When I say bittersweet, you know, there were times where everybody was hugging and crying. And then there were times where we were celebrating, you know, we're sitting there and everybody's having a drink and I was having a cigar and talking about memories of Brittany. And then I did actually go up to Rochester. They had a celebration of her life after all this. And my wife and I went up to Rochester. And again, it was just, Dawn is someone that you're not going to sell bullshit to. She, when I say persistent, I mean, she never stopped. If you ever watched the 2020 special we did, she just has this look like there's just nothing that was going to stop. I mean, first of all, moms are incredible generally, yep, for the most part. But you have a mom who just, she would tell FBI agents off, United States attorneys off, detectives. She did not care. If she felt like you were feeding her a line, she called you out on it. And she just, and Moody himself, this is a true story, Moody is in a restaurant and there's a billboard with Britney's picture on it that Don had arranged to have put up. And he says to Angel Voss, "I wish she would just go away." That shows you the power of persistence, the power of a victim's mom getting that killer to the point where he's like, "God, I just wish she'd go away." And she didn't. You know, I'm telling you, those investigators were incredible. But if she didn't stay on the investigation generally, this case could have found itself into a dusty box somewhere and we would never have the answers. It was Don and the FBI. You know, I have to say that because I was there.
Yeah.
As far as Moody goes, this kind of criminal, I feel like there's more to his story, right? So are there any possibilities that there are other girls that this guy has done something awful to that we don't know about yet?
Yes, absolutely. Yeah. So whether or not that's, you know, I would say yes, because someone with these insatiable proclivities in California in the 1980s serves 20 years in prison only to get out and do the very same thing again is incapable of keeping those desires at bay. So if I'm a betting man, I say yes. Knowing what I know about this case, there are likely other individuals who may have encountered Raymond Moody along the way. Where that goes kind of remains to be seen, if anywhere. I mean, Moody is away for the rest of his life, which is a great thing. He should have been away for the rest of his life in California. I mean, that system failed Brittany Drexel and failed whoever Raymond Moody victimized along the way.
Yeah, I'm curious to stay up to date on his name, not to glorify him at all, but to see if there are any other victims that come up. I would be willing to bet investigators are circling back around to any missing persons in that area and talking.
Well, I wouldn't want these guys, the three guys involved in particular on this case, I wouldn't want them on my trail. I could tell you that much.
I hope that they've not stopped. I hope they didn't stop with Brittany, because there could very well be others in that area.
Yeah. And again, I don't want to jeopardize anything other than to say you make a very good point.
Great.
And you weren't the first and only one to make it.
Good. Nope. So, no.
Yeah, well, like I'm not a genius. I think it's pretty obvious. Like, this guy is, this guy is, you know, we've seen a lot of pieces of crap on True Crime Cast. And unfortunately the stories are often pretty similar.
I mean, Moody, as I said, he describes himself as a monster. I mean, is there a better way to describe someone who would hurt little girls? And, you know, there's really not much, there's not a better description for what he is.
How long did he and his girlfriend date Angel?
They were together. So they were together in 2009. So, and they were still dating and together up until he went into jail and sometime after. So at least the 13 years, probably about 14 years, I think. If I know the timeline, about 14 years.
So she's the
and
key.
She has grandchildren. I mean, Raymond was, you know, they were saying he was a grandfather to these kids, whatever. I mean, so, you know, you have a guy who shows the world one face and lives another way, you know, entirely. And Moody is capable of that. And if you listen to Ernie Merchant talk, Moody conned him in many ways, you know, to the point where Ernie was in love with him. You know, he wanted to share his life with him and learned very fast that this was not somebody he wanted to be with.
I hope that, and I don't want you to talk about her case. I certainly don't want to jeopardize it, but police have leverage with her now. So if she knows more, this is a good opportunity for her to sing and maybe reduce some sentences coming
her way. A Google of Brittany Drexel will bring you up some recent articles to do with Angel. So there's, like you said in the last week, there have been some updates there. Going back to Raymond, you mentioned him being the kind of guy you don't want to mess with. It almost seems too easy once they pinned him down, the confession and leading to the body. Was there other evidence there? And was the plea a deal with something taken off the table, or did he just plead guilty and let sentencing be what it was.
I think once Raymond Moody, and look, he's in the best position to know why he did what he did as far as the plea. Mm-hmm. But here's what was known. There's a part of him, I think, that was exhausted from living with this, I'm sure.
Yep.
But in addition to that, these investigators hit him with a vehicle. They finally figured out, they tied Moody to a vehicle. It was a green Ford Explorer. Once they tied him to that vehicle, they kind of had him. You know, they had phone records, the vehicle, Angel's statement. They confronted him with all this, and he basically said, all right, I'll tell you. You know, but I mean, that was basically it. There was no smoking gun. There was a lot of evidence taken together really made the picture of Moody encountered her. They have the picture of that vehicle right there. They have him being scratched up the next day. They have statements of Angel putting herself there with him. I think Moody at that point went into a mode where he wanted to protect her, Angel, and provide a narrative that would insulate her. And that's what he did.
It's coming around, though. what happens in the dark?
As I watched that, Vowsk, she gave what's called a proffer. And I don't know how familiar you guys are with this concept, but it's basically you give investigators all this information and cannot be charged for what you tell them. Okay. Unless you lie. Mm-hmm. And to undo a proffer is not a light lift. Okay. It's not something. So when this all went down and she had provided her statement, it was all wrapped up in a nice bow. It was consistent with what Raymond said. Part of me said, like, hey, Moody's on the shelf. We're done. Right. I mean, I don't know that anybody's ever going to charge Angel. She has this proffer. These investigators picked apart her story and moved forward on her charges, proving the lies. So where they go from there is anybody's guess at this point, but you got to give them credit. I mean, nobody, you know, certainly there are people very close to the case that wanted to see her consequence, but the public at large felt like they got their pound of flesh from Moody and they found Brittany and things of that nature. So I give them a tremendous amount of credit.
I'm not very familiar with a proffer, and I don't know that I've heard that come up.
Not very often, yeah, so, if at all.
So if you don't mind.
It's a tool of investigators. Basically, you get what's called a proffer letter that says, we're interviewing you on this date and time. The information you're about to provide to us must be truthful. You will not be prosecuted for the information you tell us. But ultimately, there's a bigger fish, you understand. So It's information that will lead to the arrest or the solving of a crime.
I think what we usually hear about is just an immunity deal. Is this the same thing using different terminology? Is it different than
you can have an immunity deal without a proffer.
Okay.
The proffer is really, it's part of that, you know, but a proffer is an actual distinct process. Okay. You know, there's the letter of protection. You give the investigators your statement and you are at that point insulated from prosecution for whatever you say.
Yeah, that's interesting. I'm just curious, is there like a tipping point where, as an investigator, if you're investigating Jamie, but I know what's happened or was involved in a lesser degree, is there a point where I say so much to damn myself that the proffer's out the window at that point?
As it's related to this particular case and the government, look, they're not engaged. They're not entering into a proffer with you because you don't know anything. They know you're going to come clean and tell them things probably that they don't know, too. So long as it's in the atmosphere of that particular case, you're protected.
That's so fascinating. That's interesting.
Yeah, you don't hear a lot about that at all. This was seemingly a different role for you, stepping out of the prosecutor's chair. And I know you've done a lot of different types of work. Have you done other work like this to work with a victim's family, or is this really the main one? And either way, is this work you're interested in doing?
Well, I've done it and I'm sitting in my civil law firm right now as we're talking. So I've done it in my civil practice. Yeah. I've sued religious organizations and institutions for sexual abuse victims. I've for whatever reason, my career ended up where I was always fighting for victims, whether it's a victim of an institution, whether it's a victim of a crime. So, yeah, I have to say, to the next Don Drexel of the world, I will do what I can if those folks reach out to me. It's hard to say no, and it's certainly something I enjoy doing. It's rewarding in its own right. If the right cases come along down the road and I think I could be of assistance, I'll do that. I initially resisted helping Don because I thought, this is a case in South Carolina. I'm in Pennsylvania. What am I going to do? I'm not even licensed down there. But Don, being as persistent as she is, my role just kept expanding. And next thing you know, I was in and there was no turning back. And I'm glad I was.
Are folks in your role in that capacity ever able to be appointed by a court and paid for, or is that all private?
Not typically. I think courts, typically prosecutors' offices have victims units or victims advocate units that work hand in hand with them. If a victim actually engages their own personal attorney, it's usually on their dime, or if they have an attorney that's willing to work with them for free, that's typically what happens.
It is just such a, I think we mentioned last time we have a local case where a family's waiting for justice and it's been as long as Brittany's family has. And I just, I would like to see them have some kind of an attorney, advocating for them and making sure things are getting done. And it would be awesome in some cases to have that court appointed.
I agree. Sometimes I felt like, when you bring somebody to the doctors with you when you're getting a diagnosis, so they're listening and all you're thinking about is, oh my God, I'm really sick. I am not listening to a word this person's saying. Sometimes I felt like that person,
yeah,
because so much information was coming so fast. But other times, I think really my role primarily in this case was Don had lost faith in law enforcement. Okay. And I would absorb what they were saying, listen to what they were saying, ask questions on behalf of Don. Not that she needed me to, she would ask her own too. And we would reconvene or we would break down what we were told and just kind of support her and say, look, what these guys are saying is very good. I mean, this is progress. This is not a lie. This is not selling you a line of BS. So really, that was my bigger role. And the investigators didn't have to let me into meetings or to talk to me at all. I mean, the last thing you want is to deal with another set of lawyers. But these guys were very good. I tried to be respectful. I didn't overstep. I wasn't like, hey, guys, I'm this homicide prosecutor from up north. Like, I just kind of said, and I was very frank with them. I'm like, she wants to trust you. She wants to believe in you. I want to help make that happen. And if I feel like what you're telling me is honest and honorable, we will restore that trust. And I think together we did that.
Awesome. Well, thank you on behalf of everybody for all your work.
Oh, thanks, man. Listen, I was I had a very small role in that particular matter, but an honorable, it was an honor for me to be a part of it.
Yeah. I'd like to hereby declare Jarrett as our True Crime Cast attorney, if ever needed.
let's make sure that's pro bono first, yeah. If that's all
right. Yeah, that's right. Wait till you get my bill.
Right? Yeah, we can't have you on retainer. We'll just call you when we need you. Just know you're our guy.
That's great.
The last time we talked, you were just starting some new projects with Lauren Conlon, who kind of connected us. And now you guys are knee deep. You might be neck deep in what you're doing. What are the projects?
So we have every Wednesday night, we decided to make our show a live show on YouTube. So we're on the Primetime Crime show on YouTube. So every Wednesday night at 8, we have guests. Sometimes it's just Lauren and I, cause we have a lot to say, but if you get a chance to like, and subscribe, please do. And we're on Spotify as well, but we have also, I do a lot of true crime documentaries. Lauren and I are regularly on Nancy Grace. We're on, Dan Abrams Live. And then I just finished filming, a special last week. So one of the shows I've had the pleasure of doing is Crime Nation. We did Drexel on Crime Nation, yeah. And Crime Nation season 2 is in production right now. So I and possibly and very likely Lauren will be part of some of the episodes for Crime Nation season 2. And if anybody gets a chance, Crime Nation is an awesome show. I mean, the directors they bring in, just the cinematography alone is incredible. Like, they spare no expense. It's just top-notch operation. So I spent past 4 days filming a show for Crime Nation, which was tremendous fun.
Awesome. Well, as soon as that comes out, we follow you on social media. We'll absolutely share that as well. But until then, we'll come up with another reason to bring you back, Jarrett. Thanks.
Well, we're going to bring you guys on to Prime Time Crime. How about that?
I've got a face for radio.
If there's a video component, we may need to. Maybe our avatars can be there. That sounds great.
Well, listen, we'll do it. Come on. Give yourselves a little credit, right, guys? So absolutely, let's do that. It's my turn to have you on. So we'll make that happen.
I'd like to see what this country boy would do in New York. So I'll have to work something out. No,
absolutely, Jarrett. Thanks so much. And we look forward to working again soon.
My pleasure. Great to see you guys. Have a good one.
Man, awesome. We really appreciate it.
My pleasure, guys.
You've listened to True Crime Cast, distributed by Stoveleg Media. Check out Stoveleg.com to find out more about your hosts and to find other podcasts to listen to. Stoveleg Media, igniting conversation.